Hello and welcome to What Did I Learn? An eight-part series of short podcasts considering Chapter 11 from the book Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time by Professor Carl Quigley. My learning was prompted through membership of the Telegram-based CTTM, Cutting Through the Matrix Book Club. The powers of financial capitalism had another far-reaching aim. Nothing less than to create a world system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. This system was to be controlled in a feudalistic fashion by the central banks of the world, acting in concert by secret agreements arrived at in frequent meetings and conferences. The apex of the system was to be the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, a private bank owned and controlled by the world's central banks, which were themselves private corporations. Each central bank sought to dominate its government by its ability to control treasury loans, to manipulate foreign exchanges, to influence the level of economic activity in the country, and to influence cooperative politicians by subsequent economic rewards in the business world. Carol Quigley. Tragedy and Hope, Chapter 11, Changing Economic Patterns, page 507, Germany. Germany, Quigley contends, passed through the various stages of capitalism in a different manner to that of Britain. Capital was scarce in Deutschland because savings from various sources were much less than in Britain, and as such, there was an immediate dependency by industry on banks. There were no specialized banks in Germany focused solely upon industry. Rather, German banks typically had multi areas of interest, for example, commercial promotion, investment, stockbroking, safety deposits, etc. Quigley informs us that German banks typically floated securities for industry by the granting of credit and by the taking of securities in return. Banks sold stock to the public as opportunity presented, but retained enough stock to ensure, for them, that they were in control. Banks also appointed their people as directors within related enterprises to give full effect to the control. For example, in 1908, the Dresdner Bank was holding 2 billion marks worth of securities, and by 1913 had its directors on the boards of over 200 industrial concerns. In 1929, Deutsche Bank and Discounto Gesellschaft Bank amalgamated. Together, they had directorships in 660 firms and held board chairmanships in 192. Quigley elaborates further by advising that the German credit banks acted as stockbrokers with securities left on deposit by investors. All such stock was then voted for directorships and other controls, unless, of course, investors of stock expressly forbade such to occur. However, from 1929 onward, financial capitalism began to wane in Germany. And so it progressed that German banks voted as a right all stock left as collateral for loans and all stock bought on margin. Clearly, stockbroking was a pretty important aspect of the German banking system because between 1885 and 1908, one quarter of the gross profits of the large German credit banks came directly from commissions. Quigley reveals that a highly centralized financial capitalism was built up in Germany, and its period began with the founding of Darmstadter Bank in 1853, Darmstadter being the first bank to establish systematic control over the corporations it floated. Dan Strader was also the first bank in 1859 to use promotion syndicates. Quigley goes on to indicate that promotion activity of the German banks reached its zenith, together with associated levels of corruption, in the period 1870 to 1874. Significantly, in this period, 875 stock companies and 3.3 billion plus marks in assets were floated. Comparatively, in the 19 years 1851 to 1870, just 297 companies with 2.4 plus billion marks in assets had been floated. Strikingly, Quigley goes on to note that of those 875 companies founded in the years 1870 to 1874, 123 were in the process of liquidation, and 37 were bankrupt as early as September 1874. And then there was action and reaction. In 1883, the German government enacted a law strictly regulating bank promotion. As such, bankers were now significantly circumscribed in their ability to make fortunes. This made it necessary for them, instead, to chase fortunes via a consolidation of control over industrial corporations, and on a long-term basis. And so, it was short-term killings out for the German bankers, and this being in stark contrast to the situation in the US, in which no such legal restrictions existed against any attempted short-term killings via the banking promotions process. Quigley notes that equity capital had provided a sounder financing arrangement for German firms rather than that of fixed interest bonds, a banking promotion favoured approach. Notable is the fact that financial capitalism was at its peak in Germany in the years just before 1914, and was, at that time, under the control of a centralized oligarchy. The Reichsbank, which was controlled to a significant degree by government, was central, though its control over the other German banks was weak, a situation particularly favored by the oligarchy. The Reichsbank, Quigley contends, was weak in influence over two important elements within the economic mix, namely, 1. The rediscount rate, and 2. Open market operations. A German law of 1899 had tried to strengthen the Reichsbank's hand by forcing other banks to adjust their discount rates into alignment with the Reichsbank. However, such turned out never to have been an effective control. Quigley observes that in the matter of open market, there existed a reluctance to speculate in government securities, and a preference by the other banks to remain more responsive to the conditions of their portfolios of commercial paper and securities rather than the size of their gold reserves. Quigley reveals that it was not until 1909 that the Reichsbank introduced a deliberate policy of control through open market operations, which in and of itself ultimately turned out to have been ineffective. And so, World War I completely ended the Reichsbank's policy of control through open markets, during which period, mainly 1914 to 1929, the additional impact of such issues as inflation and indeed the Dawes Plan provided the ultimate coup de grace. The Dawes Plan had emerged to facilitate a reduction in Germany's annual reparation payments, and to allow for an increase in the same over time, in line with improvements within the German economy. Quigley concludes with the observation that because of the aforementioned weakness in the Reichsbank, the actual control of German financial capitalism rested within the credit banks, that is, beyond the control of the government, and as such, in private hands. The German great banks, so-called, held the lion's share of power within the German economy, and particularly so in the period 1865 to 1915. In 1907, there were 421 German credit banks with a combined total of 13.2 plus billion marks in capital, with the eight German banks holding 44% of the total capital. Quigley points out that the combined position of the great banks was even stronger because of their control reach within the numerous other German banks. Quigley goes on to further state that in 1907, Robert Franz, editor of Der Deutsche Ökonomist, estimated that the eight great banks actually controlled 74% of the capital assets of all 421 credit banks. Post-war inflation, the Depression, and indeed the actions of Hitler after 1933 served to totally spike financial capitalism in Germany. The once vice grip of financial capitalism was finally released when, in late 1923, inflation ended and cartels were given special legal status with their own cartels court for dispute resolution. The cartels decree was November the 2nd, 1923. Quigley reveals that the former great control structure, which had been known as the Steins Combine, upon the death of Hugo Steins, a German industrialist, in April 1924, began to fall apart. At the time of his death, Hugo Steins had complete control over 107 large enterprises, that is, heavy industry and shipping, together with significant interests in 4,500 other companies. Notable is the fact that much of German savings had been wiped out by inflation. But despite this, there yet remained a significant need for capital in post-1924 Germany. And so, Quigley observes that outside influence began to bear upon the German economy, with billions of marks in loans coming into Germany from foreign sources. In addition, Quigley notes that, ultimately, all the great banks, with but one exception, as a result of the Depression period 1929 to 1934, had to be rescued by the German government, and that such was achieved via the acquisition by government of the capital stocks of the troubled banks. However, in 1937, all government-controlled banks were returned to private ownership, but by which time private industry had already escaped financial controls. Quigley points to the beginnings of financial capitalism in Germany as arising during the generation before World War I, and that from 1870, financial capitalists had been trying to integrate enterprises for the purpose of reducing competition. In pursuit of such aims and in the coal, iron and steel industries, the financial capitalists tended towards the use of cartels, while in the newer lines, for example, electrical, chemical, etc., they tended towards the use of great monopolistic firms. Quigley records the fact that there were 250 cartels in existence in 1896, 80 of which being in iron and steel. A Reichstag investigation of cartels in 1905 revealed the existence of 385 cartels, of which 92 were in coal and metals. It is interesting to note that not long after 1905, the government stepped in to assist the cartels by, for example, the law of 1910, which forced potash manufacturers to become members of the potash cartel. Incredibly, Quigley notes that according to the Federation of German Industries in 1923, there were 1,500 cartels, which of course now had special legal status, and even had a special court created for them the following year. By 1931, there were no less than 2,500 cartels, with monopoly capitalism now surging towards a complete takeover of the German economic system. Quigley notes that private control of the economic system was now assured via a combination of the release of control from the banks and favourable legislation enacted by government, for example, the new corporation law of 1937. However, perhaps key was the fact that industry was now in a position to finance itself, thus obviating any need for bank involvement. Quigley notes that the new, privately managed monopoly capitalism was organized hierarchically and in such a bemusingly intricate manner that it might be understood only following a lifetime of study. And so for Germany, it seemed that the size of enterprises had grown so big that in most fields a relatively small number of such enterprises could and did dominate. Notable is the reality that cartels working between corporations fixed prices, fixed markets, and fixed output quotas for all important products. For example, in 1937 there were 260 coal mining companies. When total mining output was examined, it was found that 21 companies accounted for 90% of the output, 5 companies for 50% of the output, and 1 company for 14% of the output. 5 cartels were involved, of which 1 controlled 81% of the output, and 2, in combination, controlled 94% of the output. Also interesting to note was the fact that most mines were owned subsidiaries of other corporations, which used coal, for example, metal producers or chemical producers. Quigley notes that similar concentrations existed also in other lines of economic activity. He goes on then to provide several examples of such concentrations and concludes that competition could never truly exist with such levels of concentration. He examples the strange hold of cartels by noting that the growth of cartels in the 40-year period 1890 to 1930 had led to a 100% control of the output of German ferrous metals production, and went on to state that cartels managed prices, production markets, enforcing their will by means of fines or boycotts. Nice bunch of fellas, eh? The cartel rot had spread far and wide, because there also existed at that time an international steel cartel modelled on and dominated by Germany's. And incredibly, the international cartel controlled 2/3 of the world's steel production and 5/6 of the world's foreign trade in steel. Quigley goes on to note that Friedrich Flick, a German industrialist and later convicted Nazi war criminal, the latter fact, of course, not mentioned by Quigley, had a majority ownership in Gelsenkirchener Bergwerk, which in turn had major control of United Steelworks. Apparently, Flick sold his control to the German government for 167% of its value, after first threatening to sell it to a French firm. Good, loyal, patriotic German, eh? Post Hitler's arrival, the ownership by the government was reverted to a majority privatization with a reduction in government holding to 25%. Flick remained as director of United Steelworks while at the same time being chairman of the boards of 4 other great steel companies. Quigley notes that it was very likely that the steel industry in Germany in 1937 was controlled by no more than 5 men, of whom Flick was likely to have been the most important. He goes on to provide an example of growth with respect to IG Farben Industry, now a German chemical giant, founded in 1904 from the amalgamation of three firms. 22 years later, in 1926, IG Farben controlled two-thirds of Germany's output of chemicals and had spread into every branch of industry, having achieved 100% monopoly in dyes. Its reach included drugs, plastics, explosives, and light metals. Quigley notes that it has been said that Germany could not have fought either wars without IG Farben. By World War II, that is circa 1942, IG Farben was the largest enterprise in Germany, with over 2,332.8 million Reichsmarks in assets and 1,165 million Reichsmarks in capitalization. IG Farben had 100 subsidiaries in Germany, employing over 350,000 people. In addition, it had interests in over 700 corporations outside Germany, and had over 500 restrictive agreements on the go with foreign concerns. IG Farben's most significant agreement being one with the European Dyestuff Cartel, the latter having grown from a Swiss cartel formed back in 1918. Quigley notes that by 1929, industrial entities, for example, IG Farben in Germany, Kuhlmann in France, Siber Geigy / J.R. Geigy in Switzerland, came together to form the European Cartel. Imperial Chemicals, with a near monopoly in Britain, joined the European Cartel in 1931, the aforementioned already having an agreement with DuPont in the United States. Notable also is the fact that in dyestuffs, IG Farben, via its subsidiaries in the United States, was in a position to control 40% of the American output. Quigley reveals that IG Farben's man in Havana, so to speak, with respect to control within the US, was one Dietrich Schmitz, who was a brother of Hermann Schmitz, chairman of the board of IG Farben, and indeed several more companies, including heads up the Bank for International Settlements, or if you prefer, the Central Bank of Central Banks. How further in with the in-crowd could one possibly get than with the latter? It would appear that Dietrich was sent to the US to become a naturalized American citizen, to become managing head of the chief IG Farben subsidiary in America, namely American IG. Without question, IG Farben was the greatest example of concentrated control in German monopoly capitalism, but at the same time not untypical. The process of concentration had been moving apace, and by 1939 had arrived at a level which could not be overemphasized. In the immediate aftermath of World War II, the Kilgore Committee in the US Senate, following a detailed study of captured German records, determined that IG Farben and United Steelworks together could dominate the entire German industrial system. Quigley notes that such domination was facilitated by a complex mix of interrelated interactions, both personal and otherwise, which could not easily be demonstrated by recourse simply to statistics. However, in Germany in 1936, there were 40,000 limited liability companies with a nominal capitalization of over 20,000 million Reichsmarks. IG Farben and United Steelworks together commanded 1,344 million Reichsmarks of said capital. Incredibly, therefore, just 18 companies out of the 40,000 commanded one-sixth of the total working capital of all companies. Quigley contends that the difference between monopolistic capitalism in Germany and in other countries was simply a matter of degree. Although not realized, Britain, Japan, and other countries were not that far behind monopolistic capitalism development in Germany. Why? Because German cartels and monopolies were well publicized, in contrast to the more or less hiding of same in other countries. Quigley observes as follows. What was notable among British consolidations is not their rarity or weakness, so much as their unobtrusiveness. For example, while there was much known about Germany's IG Farben, in contrast there was relatively little known about the British vegetable oil monopoly. German monopolism, however, courted disfavour simply because of its use in pursuit of nationalistic aims. Oddly, it seemed in German contexts that it was patriotism first, with power and profit-seeking pushed into second place. In contrast, elsewhere, for example in the United States, monopoly capitalists were first businessmen, with patriotism pushed into second place. Quigley states that IG Farben and other German industrial concerns were constantly working to help Germany in its quest for power. He also observes that differences between German and other capitalists became increasingly more evident in the 1930s. Throughout the 1930s, patriotic and economic motives were in harmony within the German mind, and indeed focused in a common direction, which was to build the German nation in wealth and power as a bulwark against both Russia and the West. And then, of the capitalists in France, Britain and the United States, well, it seemed they were exorcised by the two threats of one, Bolshevism, and two, Nazism. And according to Quigley, many were willing to neglect or even increase the Nazi threat so that it might be utilized against the Bolshevik threat. Quigley goes on to highlight what he believes to have been the difference between German and other capitalists as follows. A. German nationalistic economics as distinct from the Western tradition of laissez-faire economics. B. World depression caused the threat of social revolution to appear before Nazism arose as a political danger. C. Financial capitalism was replaced faster by nationalist monopoly capitalism in Germany than it was in the West. D. Many wealthy men like Montagu Norman, Ivor Kruger, Basil Zaroff, and Henry Dietering directed public attention towards the danger of Bolshevism while maintaining a neutral or favorable attitude towards Nazism. Quigley states that the impact of World War II on Germany was quite different than that of most other countries. For France, Britain and the US, the learning was that economic stagnation and underemployment of resources were not necessary and could be avoided if the financial system was subordinated to the economic system. However, for Germany, the Nazis had already made the discovery just referred to, with respect to France, Britain and the US, and made it back in the 1930s. Somewhat academic though, when your nation is now simply a pile of rubble, eh? Germany was left with the mighty task of having to rebuild its industrial plant, but such rebuilding could not commence until a new German government was formed. As a result, the German people suffered immense hardship in the years 1945 to 1950. German labour at this time, Quigley states, was eager for almost any job and were more concerned with just making a living rather than seeking to raise any standard of living, and so a willingness to accept low wages became a key and essential feature of ultimate German economic revival. Also thrown into the mix was the influx into West Germany of millions of poverty-stricken refugees from the Soviet-occupied East, ensuring both the surplus of labour and low wages. These aspects, together with unorthodox financial operations, in their own way, contributed to German revival. Quigley notes that the signal for business opportunity availability through German economic revival was given by currency reform in West Germany in the 1950s. In essence, currency reform offered entrepreneurs the possibility of large profits through the German state's tax policies. The arrival of the European Common Market provided Germany with a mass market, and so the combination of low wages, a docile labour force, new equipment, and a system of low taxes on producers, plus many years of absence of need for defence spending, all contributed to keeping Germany's production costs low on world markets, which in turn led to the development of a flourishing export trade. And in the best tradition of why reinvent the wheel, the German example was copied both in Japan and in Italy and in France also, but somewhat differently in the latter. Quigley notes that associated new economic activity in Europe resulted in a transformative burst of economic expansion and prosperity in the common market area, which in turn heralded unprecedented mobility and affluence within European life, such being a kind never previously experienced. One example beneficiary from the economic expansion referred to by Quigley took place in the 1960s. It was in southern Italy, which appeared heretofore had a number of backward areas. Strangely, Quigley notes, the one area in Europe which apparently did not benefit from the general economic expansion seemed to have been Belgium, which, Quigley states, was hampered by obsolescent equipment and domestic social animosities. However, in France, the boom was delayed for several years on foot of acute political problems associated with the death of the Fourth Republic, that is, heralded by the Algiers crisis of 1958. End of German review. And there's more, much more. Why not check out the Alan Watt CCTM channel on YouTube, where Melissa regularly presents Redux material from the late great Alan Watt, and in addition presents her own ever-interesting real history programs. In addition, also on YouTube, you have the very excellent Hayes Reviews channel, where you can enjoy full online readings and genial host interactions relative to a huge range of truly significant books. Books which reveal truth relative to history from the very pens of movers and shakers of bygone eras. They may be gone, but to this day, we are living a dark legacy of their anti-human plans and schemes, which are being actualized by their intergenerational ideological devotees and collaborators. I hope you have found the information which was presented here to have been both interesting and indeed educational. Thank you for your time and attention, and please do check out the other 7 podcasts in this mini-series.